I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of October 8th, 2010. Despite the official proclamation that the recession is so last year, millions of homeowners are still looking for help and not getting a lot of it. The mortgage mod circus came to town here in L.A. We were there, and we'll tell you about it. One of the problems that led up to the housing bubble was that people thought, hey, buying a home is a great way to make money, right?
If you take data from, say, 1890 to 1990, and you correct for inflation, the appreciation of home prices is really just about zero.
Zero? Yeah, zero. And tell me, what is so wrong about paying for things before you buy them?
I've noticed that the clerks, once they see you're using a prepaid card, I don't want to say they wrinkle their nose.
But they kind of do. That story and more are coming up. But first, a few months ago, rescuers came to our little town here on the Pacific Ocean, not for a standard earthquake, but to treat victims of the healthcare quake. It was a massive rolling MASH unit, and thousands of people showed up for help with their aches and pains because they didn't have insurance. Well, this past weekend, another MASH unit of sorts rolled into town, this time hoping to provide at least palliative care to people who are house sick, in desperate need of mortgage assistance. Marketplace's Adrian Hill went to the scene.
Down at the Los Angeles Convention Center, thousands of people are packed into a large hall, clutching stacks of paper, waiting and waiting. They're shuffled from one line to another. The crowd claps when groups are summoned, excited to move. The event is put on by the nonprofit Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, or NACA. It runs 24 hours a day for 5 days and will help tens of thousands of people. Among them, Maria Lopez and her husband, Paul. She's a preschool teacher. He's a union electrician.
We are one of those blue-collar families that's just living check to check.
They've been charging their groceries on their credit card to try to keep up with their mortgage. But sometimes they've had to pay late, and that means extra fees.
Yes, I've contacted several lenders and brokers throughout the last year to see if there was any aid or relief that we could obtain. And unfortunately, with our personal circumstances, there wasn't much that anyone could do for us.
So they're here looking for help.
Well, whatever lowers our mortgage payments so that we can get some breathing space.
They've gone through orientation. Now they're sitting down with a counselor who goes through every detail of the family budget, all the assets and bills. How much for phones? How much for power?
Let's talk about the mortgage right now. Is it a fix or a adjustment?
And on and on. After counseling, there's more waiting, this time for the lender. People chat, take cat naps, fiddle with their papers, sit in metal folding chairs. Every so often, a rep calls out a name and calls people up to the lender's table.
Congero and Stevens.
I hear over and over that people had tried to go through their banks but weren't getting any help over the phone. I ask Mike Drotti about that complaint. He heads up the Bank of America team that's here.
I think the difference is that we could spend a lot more time with a customer here.
Andrade says by the time a customer makes it to the lender's area, NAC has made sure they have all their paperwork, that everything's in order. This week, Bank of America decided to suspend foreclosures in 50 states. The people here, though, are focused on longer-term help. Bruce Marks is the head of NACA. His organization was here in Los Angeles a year ago.
I'd love to tell you that it's gotten better, that the demand is not any greater. It's just as big and really discouraging. I think it's even bigger.
He says there are still plenty of homeowners with subprime loans they can't afford. But this time around, there are also homeowners who are struggling because of the recession. Mark says 80% of the people who come to the event will get some sort of relief in the next month or so. Some get help right here, including Dewana Hubbard.
Today meant whether I was going to go get moving boxes or just be able to embrace my kids and keep it moving forward.
She's been at the convention center trying to get help for 2.5 days, sometimes sleeping in her car. She looks really tired, but with a thin smile of relief, or maybe calm.
This is done. I'm faxing the paperwork. They generate the loan docs. I sign and I start my payments in November, and I'm on my way.
Hubbard clasps a piece of paper in her hands with her new loan terms on it. Instead of coming up with $4,300 a month, now she owes just $1,700, a number that she says is finally doable. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace Money.
Adrienne mentioned B of A's decision to suspend foreclosures. Three other big banks have done so in 23 states, and judges all over the country are starting to take a second look at foreclosure paperwork. For the bigger picture, we're joined by Nick Ritsinas, director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be back with you.
So here we are, 2 years, three into the housing crisis, and 50,000 people show up at a convention center because they're so desperate for help with their mortgages. Why isn't this getting done in other ways? Is it because the government has been using carrots instead of sticks?
Well, from the beginning, the government has encouraged, first as a cheerleader at the end of the Bush administration, and then with the Obama administration, a number of incentives using the bully pulpit. Didn't require participation, but tried to encourage servicers and investors to modify the loans. As they were doing that, however, the marketplace changed. So instead of problems with mortgages, people had problems with their jobs. And when you have a problem with a job, fixing a mortgage isn't going to help. You need to get back to work.
Well, then how many people currently in trouble are actually helpable, do you think? I mean, we hear all the time that, you know, mortgage modifications and foreclosure delays just basically kick the can down the road.
Well, in large measure, they do. They're not helpable if the only modification is to change the interest rate or extend the term. They're helpable, to use that phrase, if the investor and the servicer on behalf of the investor were willing to reduce the principal or perhaps even suspend payments for a period of time. But there's a reluctance to do that, in part because it doesn't guarantee success, and in part because of other people saying, why not me?
Well, of course, the foreclosure process has not been a smooth one, really, for anybody. And we've had this recent news that several of the major banks have put a temporary moratorium on foreclosures because of these so-called robo-signers, where bank employees were basically signing off on foreclosure notices without even looking at the paperwork. Will this kind of moratorium actually help anyone or, again, just delay things?
Well, it certainly points out that servicers were not prepared for the surge of foreclosures that took place. The processes they followed might have been good for a handful of loans, but not at the scale that they're dealing with. That's no excuse for them not to follow the rules and follow whatever the contract is. But for many people, it will only delay what will be the loss of the home. I go back again to this notion of people not working. If you're not working, getting a few more months to stay in your home doesn't necessarily help you keep your home. And indeed, for the housing market writ large, it just delays the clearing of these foreclosed homes.
Let's talk quickly about a couple of other developments. The Federal Housing Administration is tightening its lending standards. And, you know, a lot of critics have said that their standards got as loose as the banks were back a few years ago. Is this going to help or hurt the current housing situation?
Well, the Federal Housing Administration really has to walk a balance beam. On the one hand, they want to continue to extend credit primarily to first-time homebuyers who haven't been able to assemble and aggregate a large down payment that's now required. At the same time, they're concerned in so doing, they will experience losses. If they experience losses, they'll have to go back to the Congress for the dreaded bailout. Mm. And as I think we all know, the politics of the day don't particularly favor another bailout.
And a lot of the big banks announced this week that they are no longer doing what's called wholesale lending. Basically, they're not going to take loans that were done by mortgage brokers. Why are they making that move, and what does that mean for people who want to get a mortgage?
Well, they're very concerned about their responsibilities and about their liability. Some of these same banks have been involved in the recent servicing fiasco. The difficulty is, as more and more of these lenders pull out of this business and close those channels, it'll just be sort of fewer options, less competitive options for potential homeowners. But if we completely shut the door to people who reach out and find these new homeowners, we're going to be shutting the door to lots of families.
All right. Nick Ritsinas, thanks so much.
Nice to be with you.
So here's a question for the ages. Where would we be if we hadn't had a housing bubble? That's what economist Robert Shiller has been pondering for a while. He's one of the guys behind the S&P Case-Shiller Index, as well as a web application called the Gap Gauge, which seeks to tell us just how much better things could have been. I asked him where housing prices would be if the go-go aughts never happened.
Well, that's a difficult thing to know for sure, but and on a national basis, the prices have come down quite a bit, but it's still not exceptionally low. It's close to being on trend.
So we're, after all of this frenzy and then decimation, we're even?
Just about, yeah.
Wow.
But, you know, unfortunately, there was some what you call collateral damage along the way. Corporations are, you know, in trouble because their balance sheet doesn't look good at this point. So they're not hiring, and we have a big unemployment situation.
So that's the big picture. But you also break the numbers down into individual markets. Were there any surprises for you in the gap gauge as you studied what would have happened had we not had a national bubble?
Well, some of the things shocked me is how under trend some cities are. Detroit has collapsed. It's way below the trend. And you see something similar for Atlanta. I come from Detroit, and I kind of have a feeling for that city. So it never really caught the bubble. But it caught the burst, unfortunately. And it is the most underpriced city in the nation based on our gap gauge.
And Atlanta?
I don't know why Atlanta. We have a big drop in Atlanta. Didn't have a boom, so it didn't get pushed up high. But it certainly took the down. You know, now it's more than just the bursting of a bubble. We have the whole economy in trouble. So I guess it can affect even cities that weren't so bubbly.
So is it possible for us to take a lesson that, you know, the people who started to expect that their home was going to be worth, you know, 5% more, 10% more year over year, can you say what a more historically realistic expectation should be so that if things start to go out of whack, you can see that coming?
Right. I've been, Carl Case and I have been doing surveys of home buyers, and we found that indeed people thought 10% a year appreciation, that was typical.
Right.
But if you take data from, say, 1890 to 1990, and you correct home prices for inflation, the appreciation of home prices is really just about zero.
Really?
You know, there's this sense that we're running out of land, population is growing, so shouldn't housing be a great investment? I just have to report that historically it hasn't.
Then why should anybody buy a home? I mean, why would you put the time, energy, and a lot of money into buying a home if you're going to get nothing out of it?
Well, you're putting it rather starkly. I think that...
You said 0%, so that's what I'm going off of.
The decision to own rather than rent is a complicated thing. But people choose to buy typically because you can't rent what you get when you buy. So if you want a home with a yard, you want a sense of permanency, that whole picture is not very available for a renter.
Robert Schiller, thanks so much for reviewing this with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
And the conversation about all this has been rolling on Facebook this week, so go join it. And coming up later in the show, the guys behind Freakonomics explain why sometimes there's no chicken at the local chicken joint. And we'll get you hopping mad about all the fees you pay on just about everything. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is now that time in the show when we take your money questions. Here to help us out this week is Kathy Kristoff from CBS Money Watch. Welcome back, Kathy.
Thanks, Tess. It's great to be here.
So we talk quite a bit about banking and credit card fees, how they can really add up. But this week there was a development in a fee that I think a lot of us really don't pay much attention to, something called interchange fees. So tell us what happened and what those are.
Every time you use plastic to pay for something, your merchant is paying between 1.5% and 5% on that transaction to the credit card company, Visa, MasterCard, or American Express.
Just for the privilege of taking that card.
Just because you've used that card. It's very invisible to the average consumer. Merchants, though, have been complaining about this for a long time because those interchange fees have been going up and credit card use is becoming far more ubiquitous. But they've been prohibited by their contracts with MasterCard, Visa, and American Express from even mentioning that fee to you or suggesting that you pay in another way that's not as costly to them. The Justice Department this past week sued Visa, MasterCard, and American Express, and they actually even settled with Visa and MasterCard immediately. And what the settlement does is allow merchants to ignore that portion of their contract where they can't do anything about the payment method you use.
So it basically takes the muzzle off.
And it's likely to lead merchants to giving you little freebies or discounts if you use a payment method that's cheaper for them.
So you might walk up to the register and see a sign that says, pay cash, get
3% off, yeah.
What was the basis of the lawsuit? Was it basically that you can't hide this from consumers, from businesses?
The Justice Department said these contracts are anti-competitive.
Ah.
They're costing consumers money. They're secret. It's just not allowed. American Express has not yet settled, and we'll see how that works with them. Because frankly, if I were a merchant, I mean, American Express already is not as widely accepted. That apparently is because they charge among the higher interchange fees. If I were a merchant, I'd just stop accepting American Express.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones, and Amy is with us from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
How do you catch the show there?
I listen to your podcast.
Excellent. And what do you do there in Brooklyn?
Well, I assist a prop stylist, and I also do some catering.
A prop stylist? What does that involve?
We work on photo shoots for food a lot of the time, so the prop stylist is in charge of getting the plates and the tablecloth.
So you do food porn?
Sort of, kind of.
So is that something, I mean, how do you get into something like that? Were you, like, throwing lots of dinner parties and everyone loved your tables, and so you said, well, maybe I could do this for a living?
Not exactly. My first job, well, I'm actually an artist, also I'm a painter. And my first job upon coming to New York was in catering. And my favorite part of catering was always arranging the buffet. So I thought, you know, it would be fun to have, to be able to do something like this. And then someone told me about their friend who was a prop stylist. And so, it just sounded like a good idea. And then I started assisting.
So you're bringing that artistic eye to your table.
Yeah, exactly.
New York is a very expensive city. Are you able to make a decent living doing what you're doing?
I do all right, and I paid off my student loan last month.
Good for you.
Fantastic.
Just last month?
Yep, just last month.
What do you do to make sure that your budget allows you to live there?
Well, I live in a loft with about 6 roommates.
How many?
6 or 7. I kind of lose track.
Whoa.
In a loft. And does that mean that it's like all one big room, or do you have multiple rooms?
Do you have walls?
Yeah.
Yes, we have walls. And my room is about 350 square feet. And then we all share a kitchen and 2 bathrooms.
You share a kitchen. Well, I have to tell you, we only have one kitchen here at Marketplace, and it gets downright disgusting. So I can imagine when you live with 6 other people, it could be pretty gross.
Yeah. And they're all guys, too. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
This is really bad. Are you like the room mom?
I try not to be.
Yeah. So is that a living arrangement that works for you, or are you looking for something better?
Well, yeah, my boyfriend who also lives there, he has a room of his own. So he and I are ready to move into our own place. It's been great. It works pretty well with roommates, but I'm ready to have it just be the two of us and fewer personalities.
Yeah, fewer personalities, but things get a little more intimate, including having now to talk about your money situations, right?
Right.
Is that something you've done already? Have you talked about what moving in together means for your finances?
Yes, we have been talking about that. It's a little bit tricky because I've got more disposable income, so I'm totally ready to spend more. But he has a really large student loan payment. We make about the same amount of money, but he has higher expenses.
So is the question here whether you will be able to equally share those expenses?
Well, yeah, my question was kind of like, since we make the same amount of money, it makes sense that we would split the bill. But because he has this really big student loan, at one point thinking that I could just pay a larger share of the rent.
So have you talked about whether, he would be comfortable with you paying a little more?
Yeah, we talked about it. He's not too comfortable with that.
And why?
He feels like he wants to be able to pay for his cost of living.
Now, Amy, do you see yourself marrying this guy?
Yeah.
I think one of the neat things about this situation is you get the opportunity to bring up tough topics. And one of the things that you should be chatting about, frankly, is the push and pull of a long-term relationship. There may be times in the future when this situation is reversed. I would want to know whether this 50-50 thing that he's so intent on is because it's a 50-50 thing for the rest of your lives. And that might not work for me. I'm going to want somebody, my partner, to help pick me up when I'm down, and I'm going to want to do the same thing for him. So, I mean, I can see saying, okay, well, I'm never comfortable spending more than I earn, and I want to save money, and I want, you know, and if that's the crux of it, then it's a different question.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think it's more because he's a guy.
Yeah, I was going to go there in a second. You know, I do wonder if it's a bit of a, shall we say, chivalrous issue?
Yeah, he is chivalrous. You know, he likes to, you know, take me out to dinner every now and then. And he kind of enjoys those traditional gender roles, even though we don't really buy into that a lot.
I think that's charming. But I also think that it's something that you need to discuss.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
Thanks. All right. So can we place a microphone there while you have this discussion?
Tess wants to learn for her own household.
Yeah, we've thought about doing that. Actually, since we're both artists, we've thought about recording our relationship conversations as performance art.
Wow. Well, I think you should do that for this discussion about money, and then you should share it with our audience.
That could be fun.
I'll see if he'll agree to that. I don't know if he'll go for it, but.
Terrific.
All right. Does that help you out, Amy?
Yeah, that's really helpful. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Great question.
Great.
All right. Next up, Hal is on the line from Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Hal.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well. And you?
Doing very well. Thank you. Thank you for taking my question.
Oh, it is our pleasure. How do you catch the show there in Birmingham?
On WBHM.
And I understand that you're retired.
Well, yeah, I am retired. There was a lot of consolidation in the industry I was in a couple of years ago. And when the dust cleared, I found out that if I wanted to stay in the industry where I was, I'd have to relocate. And I didn't want to do that.
Yeah. May I ask how old you are?
Early 60s.
So what have you decided to do?
Actually, I'm back in school.
Okay. Good for you.
So I'm going back to the local university here and working on my PhD.
Bravo.
Wow.
I love
Wonderful.
This.
Yeah.
Love it. Now, may I ask what it's like to walk in on that first day of class with all these young whippersnappers?
Yeah, after you get over the looks like, who are you and what are you doing here and are you here to teach us something? And then they found out that I'm capable of being just as funny and immature as they are.
Fantastic.
So I fit in pretty well after a while. So.
And how many frat parties have you been to?
No, none of those. None of those.
That would be really pretty funny if you went through Rush, you know. Showed up at those parties like, I'm looking for a bid, right?
No, but, you know, honestly, it would be wonderful to have people who have been through life in a college class.
That's what I find. You know, obviously, most of the people I'm in the classroom with are half my age or younger.
Yeah.
You know, they're able to read longer and remember more short term than I am. Of course, I can always remember what happened 20 years ago better than they could.
Yeah. Well, that is just so cool. And I love getting stories from people who have started a second career. But I hope we don't have to answer questions about student loans, do we?
No. Actually, my question is not about me. It's about my oldest son.
Aha, okay.
He's decided he's going to go back to graduate school.
Just like Dad.
Just like Dad, right.
There you go.
The question that I had was about his living location. Long story short, his mom and I decided, well, we're going to try and pitch in some and help him out if we can.
How so?
We are buying a condo for him to live in because the program he's in is going to be 4 to 5 years.
So have you done this already? You bought the condo?
Going to close in 2 days.
Okay.
Wow.
My question was, he's going to be paying us a certain amount every month that's going to cover the condo association fee, the property tax, the insurance, and maybe a little bit extra. I was wondering if we should try and consider that a rental unit. My understanding is that we can claim the expenses on our tax return, depreciate it as an asset, so that when we sell it, if we don't get the money back that we put into it, at least as a depreciated asset, it will help offset some of the losses that we might incur.
Mm-hmm. Sound like a good plan, Kathy?
Yeah, no, you definitely want to use it as a rental property because actually it is a rental property.
Want to designate it what it is.
Yes.
Yeah, the fact that he was my son, I didn't know if that would complicate the matter.
Does Uncle Sam care who your tenant is?
He does, but only in one aspect. The government wants to make sure that you are asking a market return on the rental property. If you're, for instance, writing off more than you're getting in income, they're going to look very closely at the rate that you're charging for rent. And they may impute a value that would be essentially a gift to your son. So essentially, there's no problem with doing it. You need to talk to your tax advisor when you're doing your return. It may be that given the market, if you're charging below market rates, it may affect you for as long as your son is in that house. It's a very simple deal. You just want to talk to your tax advisor if you know that you're charging him less than market rates for rent.
Well, I always do my own taxes, so right now you're my tax advisor.
Well, that's a little scary because you do get what you pay for.
I know. I'm being a little bit facetious. I know that there's some more research that I need to do.
Sure.
So does that help you out?
Oh, that helps tremendously.
All right.
Thank you so much.
All right. And finally, we have Mario on the phone from Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Mario.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How do you listen to the show there?
I listen to it on the podcast.
Excellent. And I have one more question for you. What happened to the Red Sox?
Bad year for them. Bad year.
Bad, bad, bad. We need some better pitching, huh?
Yeah, less injuries.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, at least the Pats are back in action and they seem to be doing all right.
We're doing good. Delta's coming up too.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what can we help you out with today?
Well, my question is in relation to my father, helping him out with his financial situation.
Oh, this is very interesting. We just had a father who wanted to help his son, and now we have a son who wants to help his dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, vice versa. So my father has a small business, and he is under a lot of stress because he has high credit debt, ranging in upwards of $60,000.
Ay, ay, ay. What kind of business?
He owns a party supply store.
Okay.
His credit score has gone down. He recently had asked me to co-sign a car loan for him, and I originally had hesitations on it. I ended up doing it because I know that he needs it for his job.
Mm-hmm.
And I hesitated partly, you know, because I'm about to finish my graduate degree, and, you know, throughout the years accumulating some debt myself. About 3-4 years ago, while in school, I joined a debt consolidation program, which turned out to be really good. They lowered my interest rates and stuff like that.
Good. We always like to hear success stories from those.
Yeah.
Yeah, those it turned out to be better than I expected, and I just finished paying off my last payment last month, and my credit score is going back up. I ended up co-signing his car lease, and that's going okay. But then he, you know, he still feels that his situation is overwhelming, and he was considering bankruptcy.
Uh-oh.
And, you know, I suggested that he also try out the debt consolidation program. I told him it worked out for me, but it seems like the payments will still be too much for him. He was suggesting that I take ownership of the business and that he can file for bankruptcy. But I don't know that I would be affected by that.
Ooh, tough question, Kathy.
Absolutely. Mario, I would, you know, suggest that you repeat after me. Dad, I love you. I cannot be involved in any of your financial dealings. I just can't do it. If he transfers the business to you before he files bankruptcy, that's what they call a fraudulent conveyance.
Really?
Yep. And so essentially, if you take assets out of a debtor's estate,
right,
and give it to somebody else in order to, you know, get it off of your books and make it unavailable to your creditors, yeah, they go back and they pull it right back in. And then now you're in trouble, and not just economic trouble, but also legal trouble. Unfortunately, you've already signed the car lease, and so you're probably going to be on the hook for those payments. I hope. Is that something you can afford?
No, I don't think I could afford it if he were to bail out on it completely, no.
Well, let me tell you about another little service called Lease Trader, which it's an online site where you can essentially sell your auto lease to somebody else, and that transfers the obligation to somebody else. If your dad cannot make this lease on his own, I mean, you know, maybe your dad is going to be okay. Let's hope he is. But you've got to stop bailing him out. I know it must be really difficult because this isn't an arm's length transaction. This
is your dad.
Yeah.
It's always hard, you know, trying to, we come from a poor family. I'm the first to graduate college or get any advanced degree. Now I have a graduate degree almost.
Congratulations.
In December. Thank you. It's rather difficult making these decisions and having that kind of background in the family, trying to help others versus trying to help yourself. And it's always a battle. So.
Yeah. But in any case, your dad has to actually do the tough things that you did to get himself out of this trouble. And, you know, you can tell him, hey, Dad, at some point, maybe I can help you with economic stuff. But right now, it's just too soon. And I would suggest to you that one of the things you need to start thinking about is that you can help people help themselves, but you can't bail them out.
Right.
All right, Mario. Hey, let us know how it goes and what ends up happening, would you?
Yeah, I will. Thank you for your advice. I appreciate
okay.
it.
Okay. Thanks
Mario.
So much and good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got a question, let us know about it. Our voicemail is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email through the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. Kathy Kristoff, thanks so much for your help today.
Thanks, Tess.
And do remember to talk to your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Congratulations! You're becoming more responsible with your credit cards. The Federal Reserve reported this week that Americans continued to pay down their cards in August, marking two straight years of monthly declines. So does that mean we've all turned to cash? Well, no. A different kind of card is gaining in popularity, prepaid debit cards. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith has more.
Wendy Rogers finally got her PhD in May. And after 6 years of graduate school, she was strapped. So to help her out, Roger's parents got her a prepaid card at the local grocery store and loaded it up with $30 every week.
And that way I knew I had money for food. From everything from milk to toilet paper, you got $30 to spend. That's what you got.
Rogers loves the card, but says using it isn't always so comfortable.
I've noticed that the clerks, once they see you're using a prepaid card, I don't want to say they wrinkle their nose, but there is that definite shift in perception.
Traditionally, prepaid cards have been a kind of last resort for people whose credit wasn't good enough to get a checking account or a credit card.
It's a prepaid Visa card. There's no credit check. Everyone is eligible to sign up. You don't even need a bank account.
Ron Shevlin analyzes banking products for the Aite Group. He says the recession has changed our attitude toward credit and our attitude toward prepaid cards.
As a result of the downturn in the economy, a lot more consumers have become a lot more disciplined about managing their finances and are looking for ways to help them plan their budgets and, very importantly, keep to their budgets.
Dr. Wendy Rogers recently landed a job and can buy her own groceries now, but she's held on to her prepaid card, loading it up herself every week. She says it's a good budgeting tool.
It just removes the temptation to go to a coffee shop and get a cup of tea instead of groceries. It really does provide a structure that wasn't there.
The prepaid card industry is expected to top $360 billion next year. Some prepaid cards, like Wendy Rogers' grocery card, are linked to individual businesses, like Office Depot or Target. They don't tend to charge any fees, and they usually come with rewards.
Get a free 6-inch or flatbread sub when you load a Subway card with $20 or more.
I just use the card at Best Buy or on their website like cash.
Register your Starbucks card to unlock the benefits of free membership.
Those prepaid cards have some perks, but you can only use them in one place. People who want their prepaid debit cards to have more flexibility have to pay for it.
It's the prepaid Visa Rush Card. When you put money onto your Rush Card, you have 24-hour access to your funds, available in sleek black or stylish pink.
The Rush Card was started by music mogul Russell Simmons in 2003. More than 2.5 million people now use it. Most directly deposit their paychecks onto the card. Simmons says originally, most of his customers were people who couldn't get credit.
America operates on plastic. If you don't have any kind of card, you're locked out of the American dream. You can't go to the internet and buy nothing. You can't order nothing over the phone. You can't rent a hotel room.
Simmons says these days, a lot of his business is coming from people who are defecting from banks, angry about bailouts and discouraged by new restrictions and fees.
30% of our new customers have a bank account and decided like Rush Card better.
The market for Rush Cards and others like it is growing roughly 20% a year. Not that those cards are free. The Rush Card costs about $10 a month, plus extra if you want to check your balance, use an ATM more than twice a month, or get a paper statement.
You're going to have to read the fine print really, really carefully.
Robert Manning is the author of Credit Card Nation. He points out that prepaid cards are sometimes called fee harvesters and can end up costing a lot. As prepaid debit cards get more popular, Manning predicts issuers will get more creative about getting people to use them.
We're going to see all kinds of approaches where cards now are going to help you become better stewards of your financial resources.
The Rush Card offers to help people rebuild their credit score. If customers sign up to pay their bills with their Rush Card, the card will report those on-time payments to credit reporting agencies. Of course, if you want to pay your bills with the Rush Card, you'll have to pay a fee. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace Money.
I am not a fan of prepaid credit cards. Number one reason? All those hidden fees.
Our economics editor, Chris Farrell.
Of course, when it comes to fees, the credit card companies are hardly alone. Unless you think we're talking about small amounts of money, Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine estimates we could save more than $5,000 a year if we only take the time to avoid fees. But I think the loss is much more than that. This is rip-off capitalism at work. Now, some of the fees are like a slap in the face. I used to get annoyed at a $1 charge to use an out-of-network ATM. Now it's more like $3 to $5. All too many of the fees are sneaky. Look at all the charges airlines impose on such things as checked baggage, a seat with extra leg room, and early boarding. And have you ever looked at a car rental contract in an airport? Did you pay attention to the concession recovery fee? It typically runs about 11 to 13% of your rental. It's how the rental company pays the charge airports impose to do business there. Mutual fund companies, they've devised all kinds of charges. The worst may be the 12b1 fee that pays for marketing expenses. There are also the various loads or fees many mutual fund companies charge to invest with a fund. I could go on and on, but you get the point. We're being nickeled and dimed by fees. But there's only so much you and I can do. We have other things to do with our time, like work and family. That's why these fees work. Companies know we're too busy to pay attention to small charges. And that's why government regulators need to step up the fight against rip-off capitalism. For instance, thanks to legislation, 401k plans will have to make their fees and charges readily apparent to participants starting next July. Up until now, the information has been hard to find. There was minimal disclosure. Yet fees can make a huge difference to returns. The federal government could take a pro-consumer stance by forcing the airlines to make the cost of their fees easily understood. It would make for better comparison shopping online, a boon to flyers. The new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau must make fee disclosure a top priority. Meanwhile, there should be a note taped onto the computer of the modern American consumer. It's the fees, stupid.
Chris Farrell is the Marketplace Economics Editor. Express your fee outrage at marketplace.org. Letters, email, Facebook posts, hey, even the phone. We love hearing from you, and to hear from you even more, our mail lady is here, Deb Clark, who moonlights as our senior producer. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
And you're here with me again to sift through all of it. What you got this week?
Okay, Tess, as you know, one of the most popular questions we get asked here on this show is...
How can I strike it rich so I never have to work another day in my life?
Well, there is that, if only we knew. But no, I was thinking about how to pay for college.
Oh, you mean all the questions you send in on behalf of yourself?
Oh, no. Well, I do have two kids and I haven't started yet.
Oh, they're still young.
Oh, that's true. Anyway, Amy Scott did a piece for us last week looking at why some people choose not to save for college.
Right.
And one comment pointed out how expensive it is to go to college these days, said you sort of owe it to your kids to help them graduate without tons of debt.
Yeah, especially since there aren't any jobs to pay down that debt.
Right. But Tracy Ewing from Indianapolis said her family couldn't afford to save for college because they made the choice to have her stay home with the kids. It meant 6 years out of the workforce, not so great for her career, of course not great at all for saving for college, but she did think it was worth it.
I looked at it more as it was giving them an advantage simply from having me there and having knowing that I was the one who was forming, you know, the way that they would think and the way that they would approach things when they started school, and it wasn't someone else who was teaching them how they should behave.
Yeah, I think this is definitely one of those topics where there could just be endless debate.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, feel free to continue that on our Facebook page. All right, what else got people going?
Well, also on last week's program, we did that little piece about the guy who won the lottery twice in Missouri within about 3 months.
Yeah, so not fair. Of course, as I pointed out, a lot of people call lotteries a tax on fools.
Why, yes, they have. So I have to confess, I was a bit surprised to see how many of our listeners were in strong defense of buying lottery tickets.
Mm-hmm.
I read one especially good argument from a guy here in California. He said he buys about 3 tickets a month. I figure, he said, I'll never miss the dollar, but I'll certainly notice if I win $1 million.
Especially when they give you a check that's taller than you.
Yeah. Of course, we also heard from Tori Dunbar from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. She works in a chain grocery store. Said that lottery tickets are probably their biggest selling item, and she's noticed that even the smallest win gets people excited, even if they've spent a ton of money getting there.
A fellow the other day came in with a lottery ticket, and I noticed that he had spent $28, and I ran it through the machine, and I said, okay, you got $3. And he was thrilled, not realizing that he was still down $25 on that one ticket.
I think this is where we say, what were you thinking?
Yeah, good question. Well, finally, Tess, I know how much you love to sing on the show.
And you know how much everyone loves it when I do. Would you like an encore?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, thanks. No.
Okay.
But we did recently get our friend Ron Lieber from the New York Times to sing.
Yes, he was quite up in arms about all the people who attend concerts with him who can't stop, you know, chatting into their phones and chatting with their friends.
Yeah, quite a few people wrote in to essentially call Ron a killjoy.
Aww.
I know. He did have some supporters, though, including Nile Shah of Baltimore, who remembered a concert-going experience of his own.
The band is about 30 minutes into their set when the lead singer just stops. He lets the reverb play out, so it takes a couple seconds before the room is silent, except for one guy who is basically yelling into his cell phone. The singer is giving him the most vicious look I've ever seen. The man stops and is dumbstruck. The singer asks, "Are you done then? Good. Then get off the effing phone."
Oh, people language. This is a family show.
And that's all she wrote.
All right. Thanks, Deb. Keep your comments coming. Go to Facebook or go to our webpage. It's marketplace.org. Let's talk about food, my favorite topic, aside, of course, from money. This week, Yum! Brands released its latest profit report. The company owns Taco Bell and KFC and a whole host of other fast food brands, including A&W Root Beer. The company made $350 million in the past 3 months, lots of that growth from overseas sales. In fact, Yum! Opened 180 new KFCs in China this year, but it closed 24 A&W Root Beer restaurants here in the U.S., and the result has at least one Yum! Customer scratching his head. Joining us to talk about it is Marketplace's newest edition, our Freakonomics correspondent, Stephen Dubner. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tess. Thanks for having me.
So your book and our show have quite a bit in common, trying to look at, I suppose you would say, the human side of the economic equation. I think we could have some fun here.
I certainly hope so. And you're right. It's not so much about the numbers per se, but what the numbers can tell us about how people actually behave and why they behave. So you were talking about Yum! Brands a minute ago and how its U.S. growth has slowed. As it happens, just the other day, I was having a conversation about one of the Yum! Brands with Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics co-author who teaches economics at the University of Chicago.
The other day I was thirsty, and I happened to pass by an A&W root beer. So I went to the drive-thru, and I said, I'd like an A&W root beer, please. And the voice came over the microphone and said, I'm sorry, we're out of root beer. Could I get you something else? And I thought, that didn't seem like a very good way to run a restaurant. If you called A&W root beer, the one thing you might try to keep in stock was root beer.
Kind of like a bank running out of money?
Yeah, or like KFC running out of chicken.
Oh, you've had that happen,
too. I know, I've had that happen to me, too. And I was truly shocked when I went up to the counter and I asked for a bucket of chicken, and they told me that they were out of chicken.
Oh, my. A ship without a rudder, a car without wheels. Wow, that seems like a rather ridiculous business strategy. But Yum Brands, I know, owns both KFC and A&W Root Beer, and the company, as we said, is actually making money. So whatever the strategy is, it's working.
It's important to remember that Levitt is just one guy telling one anecdote, and as social scientists have to constantly remind themselves, the plural of anecdote is not data.
Now, or trend.
That said, or trend, exactly. Although for a journalist, two is a trend, right. Just so you know. Now, that said, you know, Levitt's experience does seem to at least jibe with what we're seeing in the Yum Brands report.
All right. Well, point taken. But is there any economic reason why a KFC might stop too little chicken or A&W not have any root beer?
Well, it may be that with the U.S. growth so bad that Yum is skimping on resources here. But, you know, I'm no economist. Let's hear what the actual economist, Steve Levitt, has to say. I asked him.
You know, I've hypothesized that it has to do with the income level of the customers and that wealthier customers are less willing to tolerate incredibly bad service. And I saw this when I spent a year visiting at Stanford University and I lived in Palo Alto. The share of rich people in Palo Alto is almost unparalleled. And you could
say
not,
unparalleled or unbearable?
Unparalleled.
All right.
No, I enjoyed it. But as a consequence, the service was unbelievable.
So that's a function of a well-run business, or it's a function of the employees adapting to the level of demand of customers?
I think the business can decide, do they want to pay more and have good workers, or do they just want to coast along? Do they just want to provide the minimum amount of service and get by? And it costs money to provide good service. Businesses adapt to that.
So you went to this A&W twice within like 3 days, and they had no root beer. What happens the next time you're driving by that A&W and you're thirsty?
Well, I'm going to have to see if they got the root beer yet, right?
So basically, Stephen, the argument here is that the Palm would never run out of filet mignon.
Right, because they've got a different kind of clientele who's more sensitive to that, and A&W perhaps is aware that their clientele is not.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess I don't understand the logic here of having a brand that is known for X and being out of X.
Well, you know, like the bank that runs out of money, which you don't want to happen, you do have to consider all the forces that go into it. And at some point, you know, part of it may be management, part of it may be resources, and part of it may be one guy or gal woke up and had a bad day. On the other hand, when you're thinking about it from the corporate end, as a business, your concern is that that one guy does not create for you a poor reputation. And that's what we saw here.
And I would guess for the most part that we customers don't make a stink about it.
Well, I tell you, an interesting thing happened just this week. Sun Chips, the Frito-Lay quasi-natural, quasi-healthy potato chip, which my family happens to love and consume, you know, they introduced a new biodegradable, environmentally friendly bag.
Right, and it was really, really crinkly.
Extremely crinkly. I hadn't read about this, but we had a bag in the back of my car. My kids were eating in the back of the car, and I was driving out to the beach this summer. This noise, it sounded like 100 little old ladies at once uncrinkling their hard candy in the theater. It was unbelievable. It turns out that this week, Frito-Lay, they said, we're getting rid of the bag. Partly, that was a reaction to an organized effort on Facebook by Frito-Lay customers who said, hey, we like your chips, your bag stinks. And so that's a case where the customers were heard.
To the barricades, I say. All right. Well, let's end it on that. And we want to know from the listeners out there, what should a customer do when confronted by exceptionally bad customer service? Tell us how you would respond on our sister website, freakonomicsradio.com. Stephen Dubner, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Tess. Take care.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the college campus is where lots of kids get their first credit card. They also get credit debt that can haunt them years later.
Of the 15 cards I had, I still have about 6 of them that I'm trying to figure out how to pay them off and get rid of them.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We will see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments. You can learn about Putnam's college savings plan, Putnam 529 for America, from your financial advisor or on the web at putnam.com/529.
American Public Media.